Disaster scope and types. The role of the IP in disaster recovery will vary depending on the type and scope of the event. Small incidents with no infectious disease process will likely require little IP involvement. Some healthcare facilities, however, may designate the IP as the technical specialist or assign the IP another role in the command structure. Key point: natural disasters may take many forms, and whether or not they are a concern for a facility depends heavily on the facility location and characteristics. In emergencies such as issues with water supply or an electrical outage, the IP may have an assigned role, such as to prevent/control waterborne illness or food/vaccine spoilage. The IP, and all other facility HCP, should be aware of the specific risks to their facility and their duties during any emergencies that may occur. IPs can leverage a number of resources to help them provide IPC guidance to emergency preparedness efforts. One example is the CDC's Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, program, which provides evidence-based public health emergency messages to clinicians and many other tools, such as communication strategies, conference calls, newsletters, continuing education opportunities, and email technical support. We next look at specific disasters that may require significant IP involvement. Emerging infections. The impact of emerging infections depends on the agent involved and the size of the event. Many factors affect the emergence of infectious diseases, including social, war, human migration, urbanization, microbial, genetic mutation, recombination and assortment, antimicrobial use, and environmental, earthquakes, floods, deforestation, changes in animals and insect populations, determinants. One of the largest factors affecting the emergence of new and evolving pathogens is climate change. Climate change affects human and animal health both directly and indirectly. Rising temperatures have spurred an increase in weather-related disasters, such as hurricanes, floods, and droughts, resulting in human disease and mortality. In addition, climate change has resulted in migration of animals and insects that has led to increases in zoonotic and vector-borne diseases. For example, a global increase of Aedes mosquitoes has been linked to malaria, dengue fever, Zika, and other vector-borne diseases. Pandemics. While interventions will vary with different types of disasters, the general principles of surveillance and epidemiology remain the same. During the 20th century, three influenza pandemics, in 1918/1919, 1957/1958, and 1968/1969, resulted in 53 million deaths worldwide. In 2009, a new strain of influenza A, H1N1, emerged and quickly became a pandemic, resulting in 151,700 to 575,000 deaths worldwide. The SARS-CoV-2 pandemic began in 2019 and within a year reached all seven continents. Outbreaks have the capability of evolving into pandemics if they are left undetected or uncontrolled, if reporting is not timely, or if guidance is not acted upon. For example, a 2014 Ebola outbreak began in a rural area in southeastern Guinea before crossing borders to the neighboring countries of Liberia and Sierra Leone and then jumping to another continent. Rapid reporting of clusters of cases of unknown diseases in countries at risk of disease emergence, or hot zones, can help to reduce the risk of disease transmission by enhancing prompt implementation of containment measures where needed. Access to accurate real-time data for pandemic response is critical. Key point: as experts in the fields of communicable diseases, infection prevention and control, and epidemiology, infection preventionists are poised to be at the forefront of an infectious disease disaster. As such, they must embrace their role as experts in infectious disease emergency management and assist their healthcare facility or community in becoming better prepared to rapidly, appropriately, and effectively respond. Influenza pandemics are unpredictable but recurring events with significant consequences for human health and economic well-being. Advanced planning and preparedness are critical to help mitigate the impact of a pandemic. Tools have been created by the World Health Organization, WHO, and other authorities to help nations prepare for the next influenza pandemic. The IP's role in preparing for an infectious disease pandemic will vary depending on the nature of the infection and the potential for disease transmission. Pandemic planning checklists are available from government or other sources of authoritative guidance. Such checklists typically start by identifying the pandemic coordinator and the response team, which ideally includes the IP, the facility administrator, the medical director, the hospital epidemiologist. If this is a staff position, someone from nursing administration and representatives from occupational health and safety, human resources, environmental services, facility maintenance and engineering, the dietary department, the pharmacy, the rehabilitation team, transportation services, purchasers, and others. The checklist should have space for identifying local and regional health departments, emergency preparedness groups, and key public health contacts for the healthcare facility. The checklist should also identify which stakeholders have primary responsibility over specific items in the list. A checklist should, broadly speaking, address personnel, patient management, and services and resources. Here are some key points and components that should be included in a pandemic planning checklist, some of which are adapted from a checklist developed by the Greater New York Hospital Association, GNHA, and from additional CDC recommendations. Include copies of relevant material from the nation's pandemic preparedness plan. Identify specific individuals to monitor national and regional public health advisories and specific individuals who are authorized to trigger the plan. Review and update, if needed, IPC plans and policies on standard and transmission-based precautions as well as other applicable control measures. Example, respiratory hygiene/cough etiquette practices for a respiratory illness pandemic. Recommend that the healthcare facility consider implementing a mandatory vaccination policy for all HCP if an approved vaccine is available. Identify subject matter experts to whom HCP and others can turn for advice and guidance on specific issues that arise during the pandemic. Create clear communication plans, including regular staff communication, patient communication. This may be needed in multiple languages. Visitor communication, communications for the surrounding community, dissemination and clear display of relevant information, especially risk and changes in guidance and policy, and clearly defined engagement with the public affairs/relations team. Develop staffing policies, including essential staffing, modification of responsibilities and hours, adapted in discussion with union/labor relations, staff assignments, example, if staff should be assigned to only pandemic-related units/patients or to non-pandemic-related units/patients to control transmission, staff wellness, stress and mental health management, maintenance of morale, procedures for expediting the credentialing and training of non-facility staff during a staffing crisis, just-in-time education/training, example, when guidance changes, specimen collection, and a plan for cross-training staff. Develop clearly defined patient management policies and procedures, including maintenance of services for at-risk populations during the pandemic, rapid discharge, alternate care systems, example, telehealth, mass fatality management, assessment of the facility's capacity to handle an increase in fatalities, surge management, including official notification of changes in bed availability/capacity, cohorting of symptomatic patients, policies and procedures to manage visitation, and relevant pandemic education for patients and family members. Create resource management plans that include careful management and tracking of resource supply, especially PPE, which could become scarce, correct use of and supply maintenance of EPA-approved disinfectants and other resources, appropriate rotation of relevant supplies, example, pharmacy supplies, and management of stockpiles. Document and clearly define changes to services, for example, curtailing certain services, limiting or postponing elective services, possible closure of certain units/departments, or planning for service changes due to staff shortages or increased demand. Example, pharmacy, respiratory services, etc. Develop policies and procedures for triggering changes in standards of care, including triage decision-making. For example, who has this authority and responsibility and how they are to communicate it to relevant stakeholders. Incorporate contingency plans for emergency power needs. Example, use of generators and education in their use, and what to do if services are disrupted by power outages. Include facility security information and policies, including access limitations, for staff, vendors, visitors, pre-screening, coordination and communication with law enforcement and emergency services, crowd direction, and lockdown procedures. Develop a surveillance plan for HCP and patient pandemic detection and to internally review for transmission between persons at the facility. It should include a way to implement prevention interventions such as isolation or cohorting. There should be written protocols for monitoring prevalent illnesses, for evaluation of incoming patients, and for evaluation and diagnosis of pandemic illness in HCP and patients. A tracking and detection system can help ensure sufficient HCP staffing. Each healthcare facility should adapt this checklist to meet its needs based on circumstances that include such factors as patient characteristics, facility size, scope of services, and hospital affiliation. Healthcare facilities should also incorporate information about requirements from regional and local health departments and emergency management agencies/authorities to ensure that the facility's plan is in line with other community and regional planning efforts. Bioterrorism. The CDC defines a bioterrorism attack as the deliberate release of viruses, bacteria, or other germs, agents, used to cause illness or death in people, animals, or plants. The CDC categorizes these pathogens into A, B, or C categories based on the threat they pose. While these agents are typically found in nature, they could be modified to increase their ability to cause disease or spread into the environment or to make them resistant to current medicines. IPs play an essential part in planning and preparing for biological disasters. Many of the requirements are essential steps and/or components of a general emergency management plan. According to the CDC's Bioterrorism Readiness Plan template, the following components are especially important when planning for bioterrorism events: reporting requirements and contact information. Facilities should collect internal and external contact information, email addresses, phone numbers, street addresses. This would include local, state, and national health departments, national and local law enforcement, and medical emergency services. Potential agents. Plans should include information related to common bioterrorism agents, including their mode of transmission, symptoms, preventive measures, special control measures, post-exposure management, and lab support/confirmation information. Plans should be updated when additional agents are identified. Detection of outbreaks. Bioterrorism events can be covert, unannounced, and also overt, announced, and plans should include contingencies for each. Syndromic surveillance can be used to identify potential cases prior to confirmation, which allows for faster action. Cases should then be assessed using epidemiological principles. For example, by identifying rapidly increasing incidents, significant changes in epidemic curves, or patient clusters. Infection control practices. The facility should institute isolation precautions for suspected cases, and standard precautions should be followed and carefully monitored, especially hand washing and PPE use. Procedures and policies will be needed related to patient placement and transportation, cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization of equipment/environment using appropriate EPA-registered cleaning agent, bioterrorism-related discharge management policies, and postmortem protocols. The pathology department will have to be notified of the potential agent and will need to take appropriate precautions. Funeral directors should also be notified. Post-exposure management. Plans should include procedures and policies for appropriate decontamination of patients and the environment. Information and policies related to prophylaxis and post-exposure immunization. Strategies for triage and management of large-scale and suspected exposures. And strategies for managing and mitigating the psychological aspects and impact of bioterrorism. Laboratory support and confirmation. Plans should include the appropriate, safe methods for obtaining diagnostic samples based on the suspected bioterrorism agent, lab criteria for processing potential bioterrorism agents, and information and policies related to specimen transport requirements. Patient, visitor, and public information. Strategies and policies related to the sharing and dissemination of clear, consistent, and understandable information, example, FAIA fact sheets, to patients, visitors, and general public must be developed. Additional components that could be incorporated into a bioterrorism response plan include facility assessments, drills, screening protocols, crisis management, food and water safety, environmental decontamination, prioritization of limited supplies of anti-infective therapy, and development of crisis standards of care that affect infection transmission. Surveillance for bioterrorism. Identifying date, location, and potential sources. Hospitals and clinics can have the first opportunity to recognize and initiate a response to a bioterrorism-related outbreak, and therefore they have an important role to play in the surveillance and reporting of potential bioterrorism attacks/events. The IPC program is critical to early recognition, isolation, and treatment in the case of a biological attack and is essential to reduce the spread of infection. The IP can provide assistance in the form of infection prevention expertise and knowledge, they can assist with the assessment of whether a patient's presenting illness, signs and symptoms, is typical of an endemic disease or if it is an unusual event that should raise concern. If a bioterrorism event is suspected, the IP should move quickly to initiate the hospital incident command system and activate a network of communication that involves IPC personnel, healthcare administration, local and state health departments, and other relevant government agencies. Existing local emergency plans should be reviewed and a multidisciplinary approach outlined that includes local emergency medical services, EMS, police and fire departments, and media relations in addition to healthcare providers and IPC professionals. Early control measures should be initiated immediately. All suspected biological agents require the use of standard precautions. Some necessitate a higher level of isolation. Patients with suspected or confirmed cutaneous anthrax, for example, require contact isolation, while smallpox would require combined use of standard, contact, and airborne precautions until all scabs have separated. There are certain agents for which more protective precautions may be necessary. Once notified, the facility's IP should be on alert for signs of a possible bioterrorism-related outbreak, such as rapidly increasing disease incidence, especially at uncharacteristic times, or relatively uncommon disease presentation or rapidly fatal cases. It is important to note that an IP would not be responsible for identifying a bioterrorist incident on their own. Rather, bioterrorism-related events are managed by a multidisciplinary team. The IP provides epidemiological skills and expertise in support of the team engaged in the identification of when and where the release of a biological agent has occurred or the source/vector of an emerging pathogen. This information is critical to determining at-risk groups, control measures, and, depending on the agent, who needs to be vaccinated and/or receive prophylaxis. To determine when and where the exposure took place, a thorough patient history of any and all victims of the bioterrorism attack must be taken. This history should focus on past and current symptoms, date of symptom onset, severity of illness, possible source of exposure, route of exposure, body site affected, date and location of exposure. For example, a new painless necrotic lesion on the arm might indicate cutaneous anthrax, whereas respiratory symptoms with an accompanying widened mediastinum on chest radiograph would suggest inhalation anthrax. Both diseases result from exposure to the same agent, but the route of exposure is different. Anthrax bioterrorism attack example. Bioterrorism has the potential to result in high morbidity and mortality because aerosolized biological agents can infect or kill many people in a short period of time. Even non-aerosolized attacks, such as the 2001 anthrax attack, in which anthrax-laden letters were mailed to media organizations and politicians in the United States, can result in morbidity and mortality and the need to formulate a significant healthcare, public health, and emergency management response. If a contagious agent, example, aerosolized plague or smallpox, is involved, the epidemiological investigation will be quite different than if a non-contagious agent, example, anthrax, is involved. The 2001 bioterrorism anthrax attack caused 22 cases of anthrax and 5 deaths, required the distribution of more than 10,000 doses of post-exposure prophylaxis, and cost more than $2.5 billion, yet it was, essentially, a small event involving the use of only 2 to 3 ounces of anthrax spores. An aerosolized release over a city could result in far more exposures, infections, and deaths. The decontamination portion of this cost was estimated at $320 million and involved fumigation with vaporized hydrogen peroxide, chemical decontamination using multiple products, and autoclaving. However, indoor decontamination is needed only in areas exposed to anthrax due to the bioterrorism release. The hospital patient care environment is not a risk of secondary spread of anthrax because no form of anthrax is spread by the indirect contact route. Therefore, only routine cleaning of patient care rooms is needed for patients with anthrax. Chemical emergencies. A chemical emergency can occur accidentally or as part of a bioterrorism event. The signs and symptoms of a chemical emergency most likely include a large number of HCP or patients experiencing watery eyes, twitching, choking, difficulty breathing, or loss of coordination. Dead birds and/or animals can also indicate a possible chemical emergency. Such emergencies often impact not only the healthcare facility, but also the surrounding community. Preparing to evaluate and treat victims of a chemical exposure incident is one aspect of hospital disaster preparedness. Healthcare facilities must collaborate with local and state emergency management and public health officials to coordinate preparedness and response efforts. Chemical risks present in the community, such as industrial sites or transportation routes, should be assessed in the facility's hazard vulnerability analysis. It is important to develop chemical disaster response guidelines as a part of the facility's EOP and ensure adequate training of staff members. Should a chemical emergency be suspected, the public health response must be initiated immediately. IPs should follow a process that includes contacting poison control and emergency medical services for guidance on treating exposed persons and safe ways to remove the chemical and clean the environment.